We made this.
Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast. As ever, the truth is in here. I'm your host this week, Carl Sweeney, and I'm delighted to bring you this episode in which I'm going to be talking about a new book, a new X-Files tie-in book, which is called The X-Files, Official Archives, Cryptids, Biological Anomalies, and Parapsychic Phenomena. The book is published by Abrams, released on September 15th, so I think it will have just been released by the time you're hearing this episode, hopefully. And I'm delighted to be joined today by the book's author, Paul Terry. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Carl. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
No, it's a pleasure, honestly. And I think what's even more fitting is we're recording. I'm not sure if you're aware of this. We're recording on what people are calling X-Files Day online, which is, I think, the 27th anniversary of the pilot being aired for the first time. Pretty cool, huh?
Yes, I thought that too. I was online this morning and it dawned on me that it was, you know, this is the day, September 10th, and immediately went, well, I've got to mark the moment. So I put a little gif up of that lovely little moment where Scully is afraid in the pilot and just sort of falls into the nook of, Mulder's shoulder, holding the candle. I thought it was just a nice little way to mark the moment. But how appropriate. No more appropriate date we could have connected on. So
it's crazy because I think that the 25th anniversary doesn't seem that long ago. And now here we are 27 years, you know. I should say, of course, I'm in England. Paul, you're in Los Angeles. And we're talking over Skype. And I think what's really nice is you're sat in front of what I thought was a real window with an X on it, but apparently it's not. I wonder if you could just tell the listeners what you're sat in front of, please.
Yeah, it's when season 10 was launched, a local gallery did a really great event where they had artists, a lot of local artists, do these officially licensed interpretations of some of their favorite things about the show. And this one particular one, and forgive me, I don't recall in this moment of the interview the name of the artist, but it's an incredible piece. It's basically, it's an incredibly realistic painting of Mulder's window, essentially, but with the masking tape X in the corner and a little faint glow of perhaps something extraterrestrial in the sky, in the night sky above it. But it does look cool on this sky because it looks like it's nighttime for me, which it isn't. There's definitely a heat. It's very much the daytime in LA, but it does look like I am chatting to you next to a faux Mulder window, which I hope at least adds a little bit of, you know, ambiance of Mr. Mulder to the episode.
It does. Yeah, well, it's unique. I've never, you know, seen one of those before, apart from on the show. It's great. All right, so we're going to talk about your book, of course. I'd also like to talk a bit about your background and the other things you've written, things like that. But I think what we do first when we get a guest on the podcast, when we have a new guest on, is we ask them what we call the five questions of X, just to get a sense of, you know, who we're talking to, their views on the series, things like that. It's been a while, actually, since we've done this, I think. So this should be a lot of fun. So, Paul, if I could ask you first of all, you know, just very simply, how did you first discover the X-Files?
So it was, of course, I was in England at the time, and I was a teenager who loved all this stuff, all kind of nerdy things, paranormal things, the world of the strange. And it was seeing the promotions by the BBC for it coming to the BBC. And I remember tuning in on the night of the pilot airing.
Wow.
All the lights out in my lounge with my mum, just tuning in. She loves all sci-fi and horror, stuff like that too. And it was just, as I'm sure most X-Files fans listening to this had the same experience, that it just struck me as such an amazing piece of creativity that it came fully formed. You know, the characters just felt like I'd already known them for several episodes as the pilot went on. And I was in from the start, just from that moment. And it's strange to think that it's 27 years later, because boy, that's gone fast. But I love the fact that the show has genuinely remained my favorite show of all time. You know, the whole kind of desert island show is always in the X-Files. And it makes a project like this even more surreal to be a part of.
Always has been the favorite, always will be, I imagine. Did you have any periods of like discontent? Were you there through season 9, you know, the second movie, all that?
I was, yeah. I don't tend to sort of, well, I think when I love a world of characters and the richness of that, no matter where the creators behind a show take it, I'm kind of on for the ride. I want to see kind of where they're at, what they want to bring to the characters. So I've definitely found it a really interesting space from 9 into, say, the second movie and the return seasons. I was saying the other day, actually, that on another interview, that there was so much about, especially season 11, which was, it just seemed so contemporary and so now, but at the same time, so X-Files, to be able to face head on a lot of things that we're experiencing now in terms of artificial intelligence and just different things that, you know, provoke our curiosity or provoke a sense of unease. and it doubled down on all that stuff, I guess was the best way to say, yeah, even in the 11th season, the show can still have relevance.
Yeah, it's a shame that the broader kind of attention that season 10 got wasn't replicated with season 11, I think, because they came back for 11 with some really strong episodes, I thought, you know. All right, I think you can learn a lot about a person from the second question here, which is very simply, again, what is your favourite episode of the show?
I really struggle with these ones, Carl, I'll be honest, because, you know, especially if it's a show that has 30 episodes, it's got over 200 episodes and 2 movies. I would say if I had to not be that person umming and ahhing, I probably would pick Bad Blood. It has so much about it that I love and admire, just as a piece of television, a piece of writing, piece of performance. Yes, it is one of the funnier episodes, but it doesn't shy away from the kind of the tension or the scare moments either. I love the fact that the device of the unreliable narrator is just genius from the outset. Yeah. And I love the fact that I can't think of too many cold opens that the X-Files has done where you genuinely, when you go into the title sequence, you think, well, there's no way Mulder can get out of that. You know, he's he's going to be done for murder. There's absolutely no way out of this. And I think that is such a enticing and thrilling way to go into any episode of any TV show, to do that to one of your main characters. But Bad Blood is up there, man. But honestly, there are so many. I'm gonna be cheeky and I'm gonna throw a few more in that I love, because I feel, you know, they're like all your friends and you don't want to diss. I don't think Folie à Deux gets enough attention. I think that as a brilliant thriller, and especially where it takes Mulder's character in the third act, the last 10 minutes of the show is, but I guess the fifth act in terms of TV writing.
Yeah.
That's an amazing one. I've always really loved how poignant All Things is. It always gets me. I think the use of music in that episode is really, really special. But to be honest, any of the episodes that always come to mind when I think about favourites, I'm sure a lot of fans will agree, it's those kind of moments between Mulder and Scully that you see this really special connection. So, you know, the end of Field Trip where, you know, they're going to touch, hold fingers, all the kind of comedy beats of Arcadia and Hollywood AD and Dreamland. I think, don't the Dreamland episodes get enough love? There's so much in Dreamland that I adore.
Some great choices there. I mean, Bad Blood that you mentioned, first of all. The thing with that episode is I must have seen it, what, 30 times over the years? And there are still parts of that episode that I just can't help but laugh at. You know, Mulder stamping on the bin in the office. just a great episode, you know. Very interesting that the first two you mentioned were from the fifth season, Bad Blood and Folie à Deux. I mean, if you had to pick a favourite season, which is the third question, would it be the fifth season or would you go somewhere else?
Again, it's kind of a similar setup to the first one. Because it's such a sprawling story, and I do want to say this because I don't think that the overarching story gets enough love either, because I tend to find that conversations about this show, I mean, it's natural they would go this way. Or either are you a Monster of the Week guy or are you kind of a mythology guy? Yeah. And I think that what's really special about what I just call the overarching story is that, including a lot of the Monster of the Week episodes, it's really about watching the development of all these characters, especially Mulder and Scully's relationship. And I think that there are so many, it's such a multifaceted space where the syndicate and the conspiracy exists, that in those episodes, you get so many special Mulder and Scully moments and other character moments. So I think, you know, mythology should get loads of love too. And I think on that note, about seasons, I don't think season 7 and 8 get enough love. I think that there is so many incredible things about season 7. And as it leads into 8, I can still remember watching season 8 and thinking, this just feels like one gigantic story. Because though you get those Monster of the Week episodes, it's still done under the sort of veil of what Scully's going through, trying to find Mulder. And of course, his return is in my mind, spectacular. So I would just say, in terms of picking a favorite, I want to pivot slightly and just say and shout out, I don't think 7 and 8 get enough love, but I think I would say season 2, as far as what I remember at the time watching it, thinking this show has really cranked it up several gears in terms of combining a massively eclectic array of standalone cases and this heartbreaking, you know, through line mythology of what happens to Scully, her return, the consequences of that, especially the emotional consequences to her character. So I think maybe the second season was the first time I remember sort of sitting up more in my chair going, wow, this show is really doubling down on its overarching story.
I've always thought the second season is kind of like all-star X-Files. And what I mean is that if you look at the great writers we associate with this show, they're all there in season two. You know, Darren Morgan, Chris Carter on top form. I think Vince Gilligan's first script is in season two, for instance. And there's just a lot of great stuff in there. So it's a fantastic choice. All right, question four is your favourite character. Now, this can be one of, you know, could be Mulder, can be Scully, could be somebody else, could be one of the minor characters, could be somebody we see just in one episode, anyone you like. So favourite character, Paul?
Again, I'm gonna be cheeky. I'm gonna throw a little smattering. It's such a big world, and again, I think as a person, I find it hard to pick like my favorite song by a band on of a bunch of albums. Ask me to pick my favorite Soundgarden song, I can't do it. So that's just who I am. But I would say, obviously, outside of Mulder and Scully, which they are the, you know, the absolute, they're always there as that's the through line of the whole show. I've always loved X. I think Stephen Williams has this incredibly commanding presence. Whenever he just appears, even for the briefest of scenes, he absolutely owns that scene. And Mulder always seems kind of terrified by just this that he has. So I've always loved X. I thought that when the show brought in John Doggett, I thought that Robert Patrick came fully formed. I thought it was an incredible character. The perfect kind of character to come into a show at that point for Scully to have to deal with. So the Doggett Reyes stuff I always really, really loved. But as far as other supporting characters, which had kind of more minor parts, which really left a mark on me, I mean, you cannot not adore Michael McKean in terms of what he does. Maurice Fletcher, I laugh thinking about it. I'm laughing now talking to you about the Dream Man episodes and you know, his other appearances. So I love him. And then just to give the Syndicate a little bit of love, Marita Covarrubias, of course, Laurie Holden and Krycek, Nicholas Lee, just especially their stuff together. Yeah. I just thought so deliciously nefarious. You hate them and you don't trust them, but you sort of love the fact that you do have that experience watching it.
And I believe all the actors you just mentioned were represented in did you see the charity video recently where they put lyrics to the X-Files theme song? Yeah.
Yeah, that was what a lovely thing to do. I think that I love the fact that Frank Spotnitz wasn't he putting something out there on social media, just sort of casually saying, do you want to get involved with writing some lyrics? But I believe, didn't he hold that back? What it was, the intent of it was held back until this big surprise of having the reunion. That was a lot of fun.
It was indeed, yeah. And just great to see some new X-Files, well, as well as your book coming now, but new X-Files stuff to engage with in 2020, which is fantastic. Final question then of the five questions of X is just a favourite moment. Can be a full scene, can be an exchange of dialogue, can be anything, however brief you want to make it, basically. Favourite moment of the series?
I think that, for me, I mean, the show has so many great spectacular scenes that kind of blow you away. But I've always loved, and this goes across the board, to be honest, films, television, when there's those small moments, and oftentimes it's when characters aren't even saying anything. It's just a moment that's performed that really lands with you. To kind of echo, we were talking earlier about favorite episodes. It really is all those kind of glimpse, kind of almost moments, I call them, between Mulder and Scully, where they're not there yet. They haven't, you know, had this declaration of how they really feel about each other. Things like, you know, how the ghost stole Christmas, the way that camera pulls away from them about to open their presents. There's just open their gifts. There's just this moment, and I can see it in my head now, of complete glee that Scully has on her face as they dive in to open their presents. And it's, you know, the camera's moving away from the scene. It's not even like a huge close up, but just her choice in that moment as an actor is just superb to give us that sense about what their dynamic is. Mm-hmm. I love the, I said it earlier, I love the kind of almost holding fingers moment at the end of Field Trip is beautiful. But I really love in a kind of more comedic bent of telling each other, you know, how much they mean to each other. The end of Triangle, I always think of that because Mulder is recovering and on a lot of pharmaceutical drugs. And just the fact that I believe as a fan, he's genuinely trying to tell her, going, no, I love you. Like I think he's genuine about it, but I love the fact that Scully obviously in the moment just goes with her old brother and just kind of leaves the scene thinking he's had too much from the hospital. So it, for me with characterization, it's always that stuff that I love.
I think those smaller moments you mentioned are crucial, aren't they? When the subject matter can be so outlandish, when you think the overarching story is about an invasion of the Earth and, you know, all this kind of stuff, those moments really grounded, don't they? And I think they're pivotal. Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, then. So that's your X-Files credentials established, as far as I'm concerned. That's the five questions of X with flying colours.
Did I pass? Okay, good.
Yeah, I believe so. So before we talk about your book specifically, just to get more of a sense about your background and things, because this is far from the first book you've written, I believe. Can you tell us a bit about your, you know, how did you get into writing, basically? What's your kind of background in that sense?
Well, not to do the, you know, this is your life, the full life story. I think I always gravitate towards just the creative act of just writing something, whether it's a crazy short story, or I used to come up with, I used to write my own comics as a little kid, you know, draw them all out and stuff. And then fast forwarding to kind of adulthood, I think my first taste of really enjoying writing about anything for a publication would have been at my college days at Portsmouth. I went to University of Portsmouth, and one of my most precious experiences there was actually, no disrespect to the course, but was actually the side gig, which was working, you know, obviously for free on the student magazine there. A lot of dear friendships formed there, but also just this idea of here's an assignment, go and interview a singer or a band or a filmmaker, but then write a piece about it, you know, find a way of having a voice of writing. So I highly recommend anyone who's listening to this, who's kind of in their mid-teens or around that era going towards college years, get involved with your student magazine. You will almost unconsciously learn so much about writing and being edited and that whole process, which is really fascinating. Post-college was really the magazine industry. So I very quickly was involved with a lot of licenses, official licenses. So my first magazine gig as an editor was the official Lego magazine, which, as you can imagine, was a terrible job, you know, getting to play with Lego and write. But really, to fast forward to the now, the magazine work I did was always pretty much with official licenses. So what happens there, you know, you are looking after things like the TV show Alias or the TV show Lost. I was involved with things like the Star Wars comic for a little while. And anything where you get involved with learning kind of how to look after a franchise as well as write about it, I guess is a good phrase. It's a fine balance. And my first book, actual book writing experience with my frequent collaborator, Tara Bennett, was the Lost Encyclopedia. And that came out because I was the editor for the official magazine for the show, for its run, for all six seasons of the show. So it was kind of simultaneously felt like a really perfect button on that experience with Lost, but also absolutely terrifying that it's the encyclopedia of one of the most complicated shows.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess jumping in the deep end seemed to be the norm around that time, around 2010 when that came out. So, but and then since then to the now, I've been very fortunate, very grateful for the kind of eclectic array of stuff that I've written books about. A lot of books with Tara, things about the official book for The Making of Big Trouble in Little China was a really special one to do, because I think when it's your pitch, we pitched that one to Fox. We said, you know, the 30th anniversary is coming up. We should do something. You know, can we dig into the archives and find all these great photographs from the set? Can we speak with John Carpenter and the cast and the crew, which we did, which was incredible. Those kind of moments where it's the result of an idea you've had and you kind of you feel so passionate about it, you just run with it to make it exist, is a perfect connection to this book, because it really was exactly the same situation with the X-Files.
And like you say, just a very eclectic range of stuff there. Like I was looking, so there's the Top 10 of Everything series, I believe, as well. That's an annual book, is it, that comes out every year?
Yeah. I did that for, I think it was about 5 or 6 years. I the last one I did was the 2019 book. The publisher at the time decided just to simply just discontinue with that title, which happens with those kind of compilation books and trivia books, I guess. You know, they go through cycles. I don't know whether they'll bring it back at any point, but I really enjoyed my time with them because it was, again, it's such a vastly eclectic array of things to write about. It definitely pulled in, you know, my experience working in children's publishing, kind of got that gear got re-engaged. But also it was an experience to write about really nerdy stuff. It was fun to find interesting stats about video games and comic books and movies and TV shows that would be like a statistician for a book. So that was a fun gig for, about 5 or 6 years. That was a fun run.
And did I see some study books in there related to music? Is that right? Kind of educational stuff too. Is that?
It's so funny actually. And don't feel bad. This happens all the time because the guy has the same name. He doesn't right. have a middle initial. He is Paul Terry, the writer of a lot of educational books regarding studying music. And I get it because, you know, I'm a composer and a songwriter too. So I think people draw that connection. They go, oh, he was side. Education, but the irony is my I don't really have any qualifications when it comes to music, so that's a huge irony that I could even fathom teaching someone else how to study music.
I apologize. Well, sorry about that.
It's funny. No, it's happened a bunch of times because we have the same name, you know. It's understandable.
And so you mentioned like your musical background as well, so I believe Cellarscape is hopefully this one is you. That's a solo project, is it? You are Cellarscape, is that right? You do everything related to that.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's that really came out of many moons ago when I did my first short film score, and I really loved the experience of writing music for a film, but also writing music that has just fit that film. So it can be incredibly eclectic. It doesn't have to be in one particular genre. And at this time, I was doing a lot of gigs as a kind of singer-songwriter, just with me and acoustic guitar. I was writing a bunch of songs in that space. And I just made the decision. I thought, well, I really, if it's possible, I'd really like to work hard to keep all that going. So have more experiences in film, television, and what's become also things like podcasting, because podcasting has evolved so much that I've been writing scores, original scores for, you know, docuseries that are audio docuseries, which is really fun. But also keep the songwriter side going. So Cellarscape, my first Cellarscape record was in 2006, and I wanted to separate the two. So that's kind of why I came up with a moniker, like a name for the project, so that when I release records that are in my sort of composer mode, that's as Paul Terry, and then Cellarscape is my solo project. But I work with a lot of fellow collaborators and musicians and producers that are amazingly talented. Dave Draper, I have to give a shout out because I've worked with him forever and he's an incredible producer. It's a good world to keep going back to. I love the fact that I can shift the gears, and I always use that phrase of when I'm not writing books, I'm writing music, and when I'm not writing music, I'm writing books. So it's kind of, and they're very different. They're very different, but they also have a lot of similarities in terms of execution. You have to plan in a similar way. You have to have a schedule. You have to make sure you're hitting certain marks. And if you've booked musicians to come in, like you've booked an interview to come in, you better be ready by that point, otherwise the whole thing will fall apart.
Yeah, great. I mean, I've only ever written one 12-bar blues song myself, but I can understand the point. all right, so let's talk a bit about this book then, which I know for a fact there are some listeners who are eagerly awaiting the book, have been following, there have been some previews released and things like that. And I'm sure there may well be some who are not aware of the book yet and are just hearing about it through this podcast. So I was just wondering if you could describe the X-Files official archives for people in the latter category, just who may be just hearing about the book for the first time.
Sure. So as I say, when season 10 was announced, it was literally only about a week after that announcement happened. And once I got over the excitement that the X-Files was coming back, I pitched this idea to Fox. And it was a very simple pitch. It was, you know, what kind of book I think X-Files fans would really love? The X-Files, as in the actual X-Files themselves, the case files. And it was received really well. And publishing's a funny thing. Sometimes an idea gets kind of moved around and different publishers can kind of, you know, I guess flirt with the idea for a little bit, whether they want to publish it or whether they want to get involved with developing it. But what it really came down to was in 2017, towards the end of 2017, Abrams Books signed me on to make the book, and they've been incredible. Such a wonderful place to make this kind of book, because the level of detail it required, they absolutely were on board from the start. So that's kind of the genesis of it. But when you have the green light, when you've signed the contract and you know you've, okay, now you've got to make it. You can't fail everybody now. I approached it kind of, I guess, how any fan would think they would approach it, which was I'd seen the show many times, but making an in-world book, making something that is an authentic artifact that exists in the universe of the show is a completely different experience than writing, for example, The Making of Big Trouble in Little China, because that's much more of a kind of classic making of retrospective. So this one was really about, and I did literally rewatch the entire show and made copious notes on every single episode, but through the lens of what am I seeing? Like, what am I seeing on the screen in terms of paper props, evidence that Mulder and Scully are holding? Then you also have to think about, what are they seeing? Are there scenes that they would not even have been aware of? So you've got to be very careful about when you're writing up a film report to not break that rule. If there's stuff that's not mentioned, it's because, well, they don't even know about it. They weren't even there. So as you can imagine, it's a real balancing act of, you know, pause button, walk up to the TV screen. Can I see all? There's a case revealed in glorious HD. So doing the frame by frame thing. So it was a really obsessive act in terms of almost playing detective, hunting down, did the Blu-rays reveal things for the first time, and, you know, a character's name and a name tag that's not in the credits. As I said, details on a case file, a wish list of paper props. So that was stage one. And then what I was doing whilst doing that was basically making a little note of, is this a conspiracy episode? Is it a mythology? Is it a monster of the week? But then within that, what is it about? Is it about the occult? Is it about a cryptid? And so my very large document of notes started with all these color codes, because, you know, that's what you got to do. You got to code everything. And I could see very clearly that doing the first book like this would be really great to make it about essentially some of the classic Monster of the Week episodes that go across that board of essentially terrestrial biological anomalies. So that does cater for things like cryptids through to the parapsychic humans. And then from there on, it was time to figure out, does any of this stuff exist? You know, it's a wish list for one thing, but the Fox Archives team, who were incredible, they worked really hard in going through and finding on all their tracking sheets. Because a great thing to remember, for the listeners to remember, is that this show was made mostly pre-internet. And so the storing of an archiving of items from TV shows was literally put in those kind of cardboard boxes you see at the end of the pilot in a warehouse, you know, on shelves. and they literally hadn't seen the light of day. They hadn't seen oxygen in decades. So that was the most thrilling and weird aspect of this project, was once I was inside that warehouse or going through these boxes meticulously, very carefully, you know, not anything, and hunting down the correct paper props to exist in this book. That's kind of fan brain explosion moment. But the whole Fox Archives team were incredible in helping source all that stuff.
So we're talking about stuff in the books. We see things in the case, included with the case files, things like photographs and autopsy reports and things like that. So I was wondering, how much is archive stuff? How much have you had to create or recreate for the book, if at all?
Most of it is from the archives, but yes, there are some components which were either, lost through the the winds of time in terms of stuff being stored away, or stuff that, for example, some of the graphics that are created for a lot of the screen moments on the computer screens, they would end up being something where we would do a very high resolution screen reference. And oftentimes the design team, who I must give a lot of love to, Paul Keppel and Alex Bruce from Headcase Design, incredibly talented designers, but also really committed to the in-world rules of this book. Yeah. So not only were they as obsessive as me about going, okay, well, if we're going to do this and make it, for example, like a security camera still that maybe has interference across it because maybe that adds to the story that's being investigated, that those kind of details they were all on board for, including things like, okay, these files span many, many years. And of course, font popularity changes in terms of not just publishing, but government records. So, I mean, I want everybody to know we went so obsessive about studying, and Paul and Alex were incredible about embracing that and going, okay, well, this file was 1993, so let's do some research and figure out what kind of fonts would be used on government paperwork at that time. So yeah. I promise you, not a stone was left unturned in terms of trying to capture the authenticity of that.
I think that's the kind of thing people can sense, even if they're not consciously thinking about, you know, font usage in 1993, you know, that kind of painstaking attention to detail. So how did that work then in terms of, did you write all the text and then start thinking visually, or were you always thinking visually, or was there, you know, how did that process work?
That's a great question. With any project I'm involved with, I do think visually a lot. It just helps me kind of get through what the problem is. So during that massive rewatch, I was making notes all the way through that. So for example, if there was something that felt like, okay, this would be printed out as a transcription from this interview, because this would be evidence, therefore it needs to be on that kind of printer paper and in a different font than the actual field report, or down to things like, this feels like it should have sustained a lot of heavy damage, so we need to make sure that's burned and that should be in this position of the page. So in terms of sort of giving a useful art direction to your designers, you know, it's a fine balance, because when you work with really great designers, you do want to give them some creative freedom, because that's what they do. You can't go in there as a kind of like a director of a film going, I want it my way or the highway. You need to collaborate. And yeah, they brought a ton of fantastic ideas to the table as well. But my job, I guess, was, in terms of the super obsessive nerdy author, was articulating in a Word document kind of, okay, when we hit this bit, this needs to look like this for this reason, because in the in-world nature of the case file, it absolutely has to match this, because that's what happens in the episode. Because I wasn't about to ask a design team to rewatch 200 plus episodes of the TV show. So I guess in that respect, I was trying to be as useful as possible to them.
Yeah, and I'll just say to listeners, as a visual object, this book is stunning. I've read it as a PDF, but I think as a physical object, I imagine it'd be great just to kind of flip through and pore over those things, you know.
It's heavy. It's a heavy object. Yeah, it could hold a door open. Yeah, I'm proud. Yeah. I'm proud to say that it's the production values, again, that Paul and Alex, in collaborating with Abrams Books, the production values that the publisher decided were important for this kind of official book, blow me away.
Yeah,
it blown away my expectations, what I thought it was going to turn out like.
Okay, so the book ties into the universe in a very interesting way, doesn't it? Because the basic conceit is that Layla Harrison, the character fans will remember from Alone and Scary Monsters, has been asked to collate these files after the request has come in from Purlieu Services, which is from season 11, of course. Was that idea always part of the process, or is that something that occurred to you later on? Because I thought it was a really neat way to kind of justify the book, you know?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Carl. That means a lot. It did evolve... And it's a strange kismet thing of the fact that happened in season 11. So if we do a little kind of time chart, so book is pitched in 2015 before I've even seen season 10, you know, and then I'm thinking at the time about, because not to sidebar, but one thing I was really conscious of was all the fans see before Fight the Future comes to the screens, there's that arson attack on The Office. You know, it's torched, and then you see season 6 Mulder's painstakingly with that moisture restoration trying to restore some of the files. So that was actually a bigger problem, actually, I would say, is actually thinking about, okay, if this is going to have a lot of classic episodes and classic case files from those first 5 seasons, how? how do they still exist? What's the kind of narrative thrust behind that? So that was really fun to figure out. But whilst thinking about that problem, I was thinking that, okay, what is the when of it all? When did this task begin? And it just felt very natural that there was this big gulf of time. You know, at the end of season 9, Mulder and Scully are gone, essentially, in hiding. And yes, I want to believe movie happens and Skinner kind of reconnects them briefly, but they're not reassigned to the X-Files. The X-Files isn't really a thrust of that film necessarily. In pure kismet, so we're now going into 2018. So I started really in earnest figuring out some research points end of 2017 into 2018.
Yeah.
And so literally watching that episode go out, watching it's in this, isn't it? Where it talks about Purlieu. And I just had that moment and went, wait a minute. Who's to say that the Purlieu request didn't come years before? It wouldn't have just happened last week. And in terms of also technology, in terms of government files needing to be digitized to be protected. And I just thought, well, this just feels, as I'm literally in the middle of my head, I thought, well, this feels perfect because it gives the whole project a lot of agency. It gives Skinner a great hero moment because, you know, he is trying to look after Mulder and Scully's work. And it gives, and Harrison just felt like the absolute perfect person to become a special agent. And then she'd be the, who else will be trusted to do that covertly for Skinner? Who, I can't think of anybody else who would do it.
And what's so fun about that, I think, is that because Harrison annotates the files then, and there are times when she's got this kind of fan perspective on the X-Files, isn't she? And she can note these kind of similarities or these possible links between certain cases. So Lord of the Flies has this certain similarity to Darkness Falls and that kind of thing, you know. I mean, it's great, isn't it? Because obviously fits the character perfectly because she had that kind of obsessive nature about the X-Files, yeah.
Definitely. Now, again, I love the fact you've picked up on that. That was something really important to me, that rather than it also being, I didn't want this book to feel, you know, a drier experience. I didn't want it to just be, you open up the book and then there's kind of, you know, the classic beginning of a book front page. And then here it is, a bunch of case files. I wanted it from, if it was possible, and again, huge salutes to Abrams for embracing this in-world nature. From the moment you open the book, it never breaks an in-world device. So you are just opening up this specially bound collection of cases that Harrison is guiding you through. So the fact that you do get to read Skinner's confidential letter to her explaining, and he says in the letter, I think, you know, I've not got it next to me because I can't quote myself verbatim, but the way that he describes, please do include this to prove that this is all, you know, all legit. But yeah, I love the fact that it gives it a lot more personality, I think, and also feels like there's a story component to it. And the fact that actually, if they want to, they can binge the whole book. They can sit down and read the entire thing front to back and all of her anecdotes. And maybe there's, you know, numerous Easter eggs throughout.
Yeah. Well, it's like you mentioned earlier about having to think about what Mulder and Scully wouldn't be aware of. And it's, in a way, it's the same with Layla Harrison, isn't it? Because her knowledge is obviously restricted in some ways. So you have, I think it's the host. She doesn't recognize the message from X, for instance, you know.
Yes.
So I thought when I read that, I thought, of course, she would have no idea who that character is. So that's something you had to be mindful of too, I suppose.
Oh, very much so. And, you know, that's when the kind of the in-world obsessiveness takes over, because once you've done it once on one episode or one case file, you just go, okay, well, we really have to make sure that all that ties together. But as you say, finding connections was actually really fun. Thinking about through Harrison's eyes, her seeing connections to werewolf type cases or whatever the connection was, or sometimes even where there's a few times where she's reading Mulder's notes on the report and is kind of going, yeah, I kind of see that, but it also could be this. And so it's her really, I wanted her to come across like there's also almost like a level up from her, because she's very, in the show, she's a fantastic character, super smart. You know, she essentially solves both those cases, you know, and gets the credit for it. But I wanted her to almost feel like, okay, this is a whole different situation. If I'm going to be the keeper of the original physical editions of these case files, she's going to take it super seriously, obviously.
And also she allows you, I guess, to play with the sort of unresolved nature of a lot of these cases, in the sense that she appears to have gone in several years later and tracked down like recurrent sightings of the Fluke Man and that kind of thing, which is a lot of fun too.
Yeah, that stuff was really fun. It was actually, I remember doing the rewatch and getting more excited the more that cases unresolved, going, okay, this is fun. How can we? And that's something that, again, working with Paul and Alex and the designers was really fun to figure out. Another layer to give this book is unique components to it that have been made specially for this book. So it isn't just, you know, a bunch of things scanned from the archives. Of course, the field reports themselves are all, you know, written, which was a huge challenge to get inside those characters' voices. But yeah, definitely adding those special components, which are in world, but also feel like the world expands a little bit more for the fans. That was really, really fun to do.
Mm. I was going to ask you, you talked about the different voices, you know, and of course it's not just Harrison and Mulder and Scully and Skinner, but even down to people like J. Edgar Hoover and all these other characters that come up. Yeah, how challenging was that? Because I definitely felt that. Like, I've written down one line of Doggett's here, because it's really fun when he comes on the scene. This is from the Roadrunner's case file, I think, where he says, I extracted something that I still don't believe I extracted from a human being, you know. And that sounds exactly like what Doggett would say, potentially, you know, in a case file. So What was that like as a challenge, getting inside those voices then?
Oh, I love that you just quoted that Doggett bit, because I was really happy with the Roadrunners case file. It honestly, that's probably one of the biggest gifts that this project gave me, because, you know, what greater gift than actually for a project being able to channel that, trying to get inside the head of those characters. I did find it more challenging at the beginning, because you kind of have to completely find different gears for each of their voices in terms of the rhythm of the sentence structures and things like that. As you say, Dog has a very specific way of talking. So really studying that and going, yeah, that's kind of how he would describe that, you know, because it's a mutant slug thing that's revered like it's Christ-like, you know. how would Doggett frame that in a field report? But I really, really enjoyed that aspect of this book. Probably one of the most favorite things about it was getting to do that and refining it, you know, looking at a draft and going, revisiting a scene from an episode and going, let's tweak that slightly there. And some of the episodes that were surprisingly more fun than I expected to drill into with that side of things were the ones where the overarching story is still really present and important with the standalone case file. So a great example is the Trinity Killers, is the kind of the quasi-vampire storyline, because Scully's still missing. And so knowing that I wanted that to be in the book, because it's perfect, you know, in terms of the subhead of the book, but writing that field report, Mulder, he's going to address it. Because he's, you know, the X-Files office has been closed for a long time and he's still really distraught about where the hell is Scully. So figuring out that kind of stuff in the case files was really interesting. The Hoover one, I will call this out. This was a great example of a glimpse and you'll miss it moment. Because even as a super fan, I had a vague recollection that this letter was shown in the show. And it's in Shapes. It's in the Manitou episode. So you see it. You actually see the letter very briefly, but that was one, and I do want to give the Headcase boys a big applause for this, because we couldn't find that prop, but we had enough references in high definition and with the freeze framing to pretty much exactly recreate what you see in that tiny moment on screen, and it felt like a really important artifact to have in the book at the front of the book, because it essentially is the founding of the X-Files. But we really obsessed over the detail with that. We wanted to make sure that the weathering of the paper was appropriate for the amount of time. There's even a typo you see on screen. There's a typo where the old manual typewriter would have crunched. So, I mean, that's the stuff that I love about these kind of projects, because you are playing detective and you're going, oh, look, there's a mistake, but we have to put the mistake in the letter, because it's there. And even in some of there's a couple of instances where some of the props for episodes of the show, they may have been an alternative to a prop or an alternative from a newspaper that maybe was off camera, was found. And maybe some of those had like a small typographical adjustment or whatever it was, or error, whatever it was. But you have to commit to those moments, I think, because it adds so much more authenticity to an in-world book, because they aren't perfect. You know, we see newspapers, we see government reports that have typos. So, you know, commit.
I think it really comes through. And you mentioned there about the Trinity Killers case, the case file about Free. And I was wondering about, because we spoke earlier about the need in the show to have this kind of personal grounding with Mulder and Scully. And ostensibly, the case file format, I mean, they wouldn't habitually be writing about all the personal development they go through on these cases. But you find ways to kind of address that, I suppose, with, for instance, some of the case files they say they've held on to for personal reasons. I'm guessing you're kind of mindful of the need to keep the characters present in that way, I suppose.
100%. And that was a really fine balancing act, because as you can imagine, if you go too far in one direction, it can come across really cheesy and it can come across just inappropriate for what is a field report. Yeah. But I really enjoyed the challenge of that, because, again, you're trying to honor the legacy of these characters and where they were in their relationship at key points as the show went on. And things like Scully's cancer, you know, there's a moment in the case file around that period of time with what she's going through, where I wanted to kind of address it, but not address it. You know, you don't want to put a hat on a hat, as they say, but that was a really fun challenge to also to show the fans that there are these nuanced references to that overarching relationship. Otherwise, again, it can be very dry. And also I wouldn't say as an accurate read, because these are characters who, would have referenced things in their life that would have been happening at key points. You know, even things like Mulder has to reference what happened with the New Spartans case, because, you know, there's a connection between that episode
the finger. Yeah,
because exactly. He's recovering. So it's those little kind of embellishments that I think you have to put into a project like this.
Yeah, that's great. And I think in terms of it not being dry, one thing I noticed was that it seemed like some of the more light-hearted case files lent themselves to a more light-hearted approach too. And, you know, I'm thinking about the fact that the bad blood file works in the phrase essentially exactly, of course. I think it's great, isn't it? Because when we hear them do things like voiceovers in the show, like you say, they may work in personal references or they may take on a slightly different tone depending on the episode. So I think the case file also reflects the kind of malleability of the show, doesn't it, I guess?
Oh, thank you for referencing that. I love the fact that you enjoy that, because you're absolutely right. When there is a case file like that, you can't write this completely serious. And also with Bad Blood, because the whole episode is about unreliable narrators and them having completely different perspectives on what even occurred. But they do hand something in, of course, at the end. Yes, it is a collaboration, but obviously it's also a compromise on what. But I actually found those kind of Easter eggs the most fun to write, because, again, you want the fans to read those kind of phrases and chuckle and have a moment of going, wow, you can almost feel the tension between also the comedy and the tension between the moment of them going, all right, are you happy with that? Yeah, all right. As long as we put that down, then yeah, fine.
Now, one of the things that was fascinating when I got to the back of the book is that in the acknowledgement section, you talk about support from Chris Carter. So I was just kind of wondering, what does that mean? What form did that support take?
Well, this is really special because, of course, Chris Carter was contacted about the project by Fox when it was pitched, and he very kindly gave it his blessing. And then throughout the project being made, through the rewatch, there were a lot of things that were coming up that I thought, well, these haven't really been, as I say, a lot of characters aren't even on IMDb as a supporting character or a minor character in the scene. But there's a lot of really key characters that sometimes you maybe get a first name or you may get a surname on name tag or whatever it is. Yeah. And I thought, well, this is the perfect opportunity, if he wants to fill in some of those blanks. And especially with the nature of being field reports, you have victims. On some of the field reports that, you know, we didn't have full names for. There are some redactions, which we'll get to in a second. I basically came up with this wish list again, another wish list, a lot of wish lists on this project, and sent that to Chris Carter's office with the kind of idea of, okay, if you would like to fill in these blanks, reveal these full names of characters and some dates, some key dates, which I couldn't find any evidence of in the show, would you like to reveal those for the first time in the book? And he said yes, and which was incredible and adds so much more. I call them hidden gems. You know, they're not really Easter eggs, they are hidden gems. They are these great little pieces of information that fans don't know yet and will find out. And there's a couple of really, really great ones that aren't insignificant, should we say, that I think fans will really, and I don't want to give them away. Delighted by finding, you probably know because you've read the whole PDF, but and the great thing, the really fun thing was, it was Chris's suggestion after that to say, well, you know, maybe Vince Gilligan and Frank Spotness want to play as well. And, you know, then via the publisher, I received an email with, again, filling in the blanks of the wish list of the episodes they're involved with and writing specifically these other character names filled out. And you're thinking, oh, this is so cool, because we're finding all these little tidbits of new information all these decades later. In an official archive book. Yeah. So that aspect of this is really special.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it for people, but there's a couple of key ones I picked up on straight away, I think. In terms of the dates, then, just as we've got onto this subject, because I'll confess, I was speaking to a couple of friends about this the other day, and because it's not giving too much away, I think, this stuff about the X-Files fire, which is said to take place in August 98, I think. And I said to somebody, did we hear that on the show? And somebody said, well, in Fight the Future, there's a telegram that says September, so maybe the end is August. So would that have been an example of something that was suggested to you, that date, or is that the kind of thing?
Yeah, I will confirm that specific date was one that I was desperate to have in the book, because it's so important, because we have to reference the fire a bunch of times in terms of the case files that you're reading. And yes, that came from Chris Carter, and it was just great to have that confirmed and have that officially in the book. So yeah.
It's amazing. You mentioned the redactions back there. So yeah, so we've got these case files with annotations from Layla Harrison. Certain things are redacted. And I think the further you read, you realize that it's not haphazard at all. It's kind of for a purpose, and you get one that was really interesting was later on, actually, Scary Monsters, where that case file has been particularly, you know, heavily redacted. So what can you tell us about that? I'm conscious you might not want to say if this ties into future projects and things, but yeah, what was the thinking there?
I would just say, in terms of this book and the narrative style of this book, is that if people see things that are redacted, nothing is done as an accident. Yeah. So I'm not suggesting that things will be revealed in a future date. I'm talking about in the world of this book.
Yeah.
That, maybe if you're reading through it as a fan, maybe wonder, well, who was responsible for these redactions? Who may have been responsible? There's a kind of clue to it's like a clue to a mystery, to an enigma wrapped in a conundrum. If you read the Skinner letter and also Harrison's letter before you really get stuck into the case files, there's a suggestion about the significance of the redaction, shall we say. But I will say that everything that was redacted in the book was done very carefully and methodically, and nothing was arbitrarily just struck through.
Yeah.
It was to create an experience, as you say, especially in the case files where there are a ton of redactions. What is left sort of peeking through the redactions is significant and is important to think about.
Yeah. And I think it adds another layer of interest, certainly. And then as we get to the end of the book, Harrison mentions that there are further volumes on, I think, Demonology, AI, Extraterrestrials, and The Syndicate. So that sounds potentially like a couple more books. Is that right? Is that the scope is there to continue this into like a two or three book series, perhaps?
It sounds potential, doesn't it? It's I would just say this is that these kind of books, these official licensed books of this nature, I'm sure everyone listening will appreciate, because I'm sure, like myself, there are shelves full of all these great tie-in books to films and TV shows we love. Nothing's ever guaranteed. It will all depend on how well this book does. It will depend on how it was received. But I would just say this as a reminder, I did rewatch the entire show and I did make code yeah. on the entire show. So if your question is, have I planned and do I have ideas for possible future volumes? Absolutely.
Yep. So I think XCast listeners, you know what you have to do, basically, after hearing that. All right, Paul. So I guess we can leave it there for now. Like I said, the book is on sale now as of September 15th. Where can people find you? Are you active on social media, things like that? Where can people find you if they would like to see more from you?
Yeah, on social media, I just use the handle of one of my music project names. So it's just at Cellarscape. So CellarScape. Just think of a wine cellar and then think of landscape and mash the two together. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
And you can just also go to my main website is paulterryprojects.com, which is kind of just the central hub of all the kind of crazy, wild, various projects I get involved with music and film and books.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Paul. It's been great to talk about this new book and just realize how intricate the design of it was and everything. I mean, it really comes through when you read it as well. But yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Carl. It's been a real pleasure and honor to be on your show. Thank you.
All right, listeners, that's all for today. But you can find the XCast in all the usual places online. So at @X_cast on Twitter. You can also find the XCast Basement on Facebook. And we're also on Instagram too. But that's it for this episode. So remember, as always, listeners, until next time, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. The Movie Palace.
Just in very general terms, general thoughts, like, is this a good book? Is this something we would recommend that people go out and spend their hard-earned money on?
Well, if you're going to spend money on a book like this, which is a larger format, sort of like a coffee table book, but a little more compact, you want to look at the quality of it. I mean, the content, I think, is really good in terms of, you know, the breadth and scope of it. It goes from 1921 to 1976. You really get a good range of letters and missives.
We dig music.
Kayfabe, it's originally a wrestling term, but it gets used a lot in describing tropes in entertainment and that kind of thing.
Okay.
Basically, it's like staying in character. So it's like The Undertaker, if he met a kid doing a sign-in, he would stay in character as this, I'm a big scary goth guy. Whereas when he got home, he'd probably, you know, put shorts and t-shirt on and you know, listen to the Bee Gees or whatever.
Ah.
And Manowar are one of those bands that kayfabe is sort of what they do.
Yeah.
So it's they're playing characters.
Frame to frame.
Michael Jordan is clearly playing a version of himself, which is very hard for somebody to do on screen, especially when acting opposite nothing. But Bob Hoskins made it look extremely effortless when he was acting opposite the cartoons. And you look at the, even now, the Paddington films, they're acting opposite a tennis ball on a stick, that just for eyelines. So it can be done extremely well, but I think a lot of people will struggle. And I think clearly, as you mentioned, Michael Jordan struggles with that aspect of it.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This Podcast Network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and hosted by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated team of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find the show on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, or inside our group, the X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, plus on Instagram by typing in the XF-Cast. If you're a fan of the show, why not support us on Patreon? Exclusive bonus episodes, early access to new episodes, plus become part of our X-Cast community in the Patreon department. To see our monthly subscription options, just head to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast. We'd love to see you join our Patreon community. We're also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod on Twitter and We Made This on Facebook. You can find a range of shows on TV, film, music, and popular culture in general on the network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.